Many of our people support Stalin as a builder of socialism. The kulaks, most of them, were Jews. The secret police at the Belomor Canal were Jews. The leader was a Jew. The chief engineer was a Jew. If the Jews would only move to an autonomous region, they would have a wonderful life.
I thanked her for sharing her thoughts with me and turned to Shekhovtsov himself. He looked imperious and bored. He drummed his fingers on the witness table, making sure the three judges could observe his superiority even as they conferred. Shekhovtsov had no lawyer. He was his own advocate. A few yards away, the woman from Vecherniya Moskva finally stood and told the judges that her lawyer could not make the session. Could she have a continuance?
"He's on vacation," she said uncertainly.
Shekhovtsov rolled his eyes. The crowd chuckled and hissed. The judge set another court date.
"A lot of rubbish, that is," my seatmate muttered. We all stood to leave. As the woman from Vecherniya Moskva left the crowded little room, she kept her head down and took quick, purposeful steps toward the door.
"Slanderer," the crowd hissed at her. "Shame on you."
Out in the parking lot, Shekhovtsov's supporters unfurled their banners and celebrated. I introduced myself to Shekhovtsov.
"Then I suppose you want to interview me," he said. "Well, I could use a lift to the train station, and maybe something to eat if you don't mind too much."
I asked Shekhovtsov why he bothered. Why was he spending all his money and energy filing suits and always losing? He looked at me, not angrily, but with a sort of kindly eye. I was a foreigner and didn't know any better.
"It is I who is restoring the historical truth," he said. "I didn't know anyone who was repressed. In the press now they are saying that in every house everyone at least knew someone who was repressed. In Kharkov I investigated 150 households, and not one said it was waiting for a knock on the door. These numbers you are hearing are all sensations, pure libel. During collectivization in 1929, my grandfather was kicked off his land and exiled. But people gave us clothing and food, and after 6 months we returned to the land. During the exile, my brother died of an inflammation of the lung. But my mother never blamed Stalin. It was the local officials. My mother is 86, and she understands this with her woman's mind. From the point of practical deeds, Stalin did more than even Lenin. But that, of course, is probably a matter of longevity. I get letters all the time from people nostalgic for the life under Stalin. Their joy in labor and love of the motherland. How they lived with heads raised high and sang patriotic songs. Right now we don't hear anyone singing. And it's not that there is an absence of songs to sing. There is an absence of faith. You see, people forget. They need to be reminded. In the 30s, when I was in the Young Pioneers and in Komsomol, there was unprecedented patriotism in this country. There was a willingness to sacrifice personal needs for the good of the nation. People had in mind great aims and a wonderful future, and so they endured. Stalin is with us, and Stalin will come. That is the mindset of a generation. We went into battle with his name on our lips. He took Russia, which had a wooden plow in its hands, and he left it with an atomic bomb. Such a man cannot be slandered. The young should learn their history. In his most celebrated suit, Shekhovtsov charged that Ales Adamovich, the Byelorussian writer and one of the leaders of Memorial, had slandered Stalin in a film called Purification. To Shekhovtsov, Adamovich represented the worst kind of liar,
a man old enough to know better, who was trying to lead the youth of the Soviet Union astray.
"People have lost the ability to learn the truth for themselves," Shukovtsov said. "They listen to Korotich and Yevtushenko. They don't read the truthful histories that have been published by the Institute of Marxism-Leninism."
"And what about Sakharov?"
"After all, Sakharov was now the nominal chairman of Memorial. Could he not be trusted either?"
"Under Brezhnev, Sakharov was exiled to Gorky so that he would not have the chance to talk about nuclear secrets or slander the system," Shukovtsov said. "Now, under Gorbachev's instructions, he has been returned. But in revenge, Sakharov is trying to slander us, and he is guiding the greatest power in the country, Memorial. Memorial can one day turn into an alternative party."
Shukovtsov said he knew Nina Andreeva and thought her a good worker. Their acquaintance seemed confirmed when he said he was quite convinced that the majority of people who slander Stalin and the homeland are Jews. A few weeks later, Shukovtsov called to tell me he had some news. He'd won his suit against Vechernaya Moskva. Not that it had slandered Stalin. But the court did rule that the paper had libeled Shukovtsov when it said that he had used Stalinist methods when he was working as a prosecutor. The paper printed a long apology, and Shukovtsov said he had won a great victory for himself and, most of all, for Stalin's good name. "The day I stop my fight," he said, "is the day I die." In the courtroom, I'd gotten a dinner invitation from a woman who described herself as a great lover of Stalin, Kira Kornienkova. She was a matronly woman in her late 50s. Plump and stern, she wore wire-rimmed glasses, and her hair was done up in a bun. She looked like a teacher who specialized in handwriting and never gave an A. Her apartment was dim, dowdy, crammed with books. She lived with her two parakeets, Tashka and Mashinka. "My children," she called to them as she poked the cage. She had never married, never wanted to. "I wanted to be free," she said. "When you have close relatives living with you, they get in the way. They are a hindrance. I've got my plan, and I'm fulfilling that plan." If she ever had a passion, it was Stalin. "I have always loved him. I have dedicated my life to him and his memory." Kira Alexeyevna was a woman unstuck in time. She spent countless days at the Lenin Library, researching the scandalous charges of Western and Soviet scholars writing on Stalin. Medvedev, Solzhenitsyn, Afanasyev, Roginsky. They were all enemies to her. She wanted to disprove everything they say about how Stalin killed millions. He didn't. He only attacked enemies of the people. Sometimes she wrote letters to the Central Committee to complain about one point or another in the avalanche of articles in the liberal press. "Feel right at home," she said, and left me in the dining room with the parakeets. She went off to cook. The room was decorated with dozens of pictures of Stalin. Stalin as a boy. Stalin with Lenin in Gorky. Stalin on the front page of Pravda. Stalin in white military dress. She had hundreds more photographs in albums and shoeboxes. She had stacks of photos wrapped with purple silk ribbons. "I've never seen anything like this," I said, shouting politely down the hall as if I were admiring my hostess's Matisse. "Oh, I've got lots of them," she said, shouting back from the kitchen. "Look, look." She came running down the hall, flushed. She started shuffling through a stack of pictures. "Look," she said, thrusting them a few inches from my eyes. "Each one shows a different emotion, every stage of that great man's life." Kira glowed. "Like a lover of Wagner, who goes every year to Bayreuth, Kornienkova took an annual pilgrimage to Gori. Sometimes, she said, she went twice a year. Once on the anniversary of Stalin's death, once to celebrate Victory Day. There are a lot of people who think as I do. In 1979, we gathered there for the centenary of his birth. I think more than 30,000 people visited the Stalin Museum that day. People who want to build a monument to the so-called victims of Stalin should think about that a little. It's not necessary to build a monument to people who were imprisoned. They had something to answer for. It's not necessary to build monuments for rich peasants who were purged. They should build monuments to the communists. Traitors don't deserve monuments. Kira served pot roast and potatoes. By the by, it seemed, she said that two of her relatives had been sent to the camps during the purges. Their crime had been being late to work. They were properly judged, Kira said. I didn't say anything at all. Tashka and Mashinka twittered in their cage. Kira's voice rose in anger. Was it Stalin's fault that my uncles were out late drinking and came in late for work? They had to be punished for that. I am a person who loves order. I am for real order, an iron hand or some other kind of hand. I am for a situation in which people are answerable for their deeds. The food was delicious, but Kira Alexeyevna did not eat. She lectured. She swooned. She ascended to rapture. I only wish we could be living in such merry days as we had then, she said. When you see the documentary films, you can see how animated people were, how happy they were. Their faces glowed. They had poor tools, but they worked, and they loved working. And now we are supposed to think that labor is monkey's work. It was always so wonderful for the people to tell Stalin about their successes. I was only 18 when Stalin was alive, but I could see how my mother worked in those years. She didn't work because she was afraid of anything, but for the sheer pleasure of it. Those parades on Red Square were some of the happiest days of our lives. I asked her if she had ever actually seen Stalin. Kira's eyes watered as if she had suddenly been swept by a wave of memory. Love recalled. The last time I saw Stalin was in 1952. I remember the mood of the workers when, at first, Stalin could not be seen standing on the Lenin mausoleum. They mourned. But then he appeared, and you cannot quite imagine the happiness we felt. He was quite old by then, and we greeted him with such joy. We were all fulfilling the tasks he had set out for us. We were ready to go to the moon for him. We loved Stalin. We believed in him with all our hearts. When I asked Kira how she had reacted to Stalin's death, she told me, and cried all the while. After she heard the news, she said she felt ill and would not leave the apartment for several days. On the day of the funeral I went out into the street, and you could hear all the factory sirens wailing, she said. They used to do that when a worker left a plant forever, and now they were wailing for Stalin. Nowadays we have no such passion for our leader. Everyone gets his salary, but there is no food. How can I believe in these rulers? I believe in real things. After dinner, Kira told me that she had once been friends—oh, well, not friends, but comrades—with a few of Stalin's relatives. She had even visited Molotov at his dacha. Molotov, she said, had the eyes of wisdom. Until he died in his 90s, Molotov would tell all his visitors that Stalin had acted rightly. There had been enemies, and enemies, he said, had to be eliminated. But hadn't there been mistakes? I asked Kira Alexeyevna. Did Stalin never commit a mistake? Mistakes, she said.
Yes, he made one.
He died too soon.
There was one other visitor to the Stalin trial I wanted to see, Stalin's grandson, Yevgeny Djugashvili. There were four Stalin grandchildren still living in Moscow, a housewife, a surgeon, a theater director, and Djugashvili. The first two begged off from a meeting. I spoke with the director, a slender and quiet man named Alexander Burdansky, at his office at the Soviet Army Theater, a vast building shaped like a star. All his life he had done what he could to distance himself from Stalin. He changed his name. I think Burdansky sounds better than Stalin, don't you agree? He quit military school and always tried to look at Stalin the way an artist would. I have to carry a burden, but I am not to blame for having such a grandfather. I think and act like a normal man. I have no extreme views about Stalin. I try to understand him as a phenomenon. Shakespeare's Richard III helped me understand Stalin. Not the play so much as Richard's biography. Richard was born a hunchback, but he had talent and a quick mind. So the man wanted to prove his right to be on an equal footing with everyone else. If Burdansky had not pushed Stalin off to the boundaries of his mind, then he certainly liked to think he had. I had never known anyone to talk about Stalin with such an air of boredom and abstraction. Looking at it from a civilized point of view, he said professionally, it would be naive to regard Stalin as pure evil after he was portrayed by everyone as the friend of all peoples, children and animals, the most outstanding personality of the age, and so on. I think he correctly translated Marx's ideas into life. It was the only way to carry them through, alas. Burdansky did have one public moment of pique, an appearance on television in which he made it plain that he despised his grandfather. He outraged the Stalinist wing of the Stalin family. When I called Yevgeny Djugashvili on the phone, he said, "Just one thing. Don't talk to me about that faggot half-brother of mine. He betrayed Stalin. His grandfather." Djugashvili was the son of Yakov, who was captured by the Nazis, and when Stalin refused or failed to win his release, was executed. The day I met him, Djugashvili was preparing to retire from his job in the Defense Ministry in Moscow and retire, at the age of 55, to Tbilisi. The man who opened the door looked exactly like Stalin. A little thinner, perhaps, his mustache more a pencil line than a hairbrush, but still the resemblance was chilling. He was in full military dress and at first conducted himself with the formality of a Politburo member. We entered a room that had several portraits of Stalin on the wall and a bookcase crammed with party and military histories published in the Stalin era. There was a simple table and on it a stack of fresh paper and several sharpened pencils. "So, what is question number one?" he said, as he stared hard at me across the table. This was not a naive man. He was not so foolish as to think that an American reporter was visiting in order to do anything other than harm. And in this, I suppose, he was right. But there was no point in confronting him. I simply asked him what he thought about his grandfather, what he thought of the attacks in the press and within the party. It was the question he had expected. "I always adored Stalin," he said. "No Congress, no book or magazine article is ever going to change that and make me doubt him. He is my grandfather, first of all, and I adore him." Solzhenitsyn was an immoral scum. And as for Gorbachev, the party's authority has fallen, this is obvious. They say the fish rots from the head. And when the fish is rotten, people throw it away. Everything is moving in that direction. In the end, I think the party will be disbanded.
Djugashvili had a nasty word to say for all the obvious people. Shatrov, Afanasyev, Sakharov, Yeltsin, the leaders of Memorial. He went on for a while, too, about the latest plays and television programs that had slandered his grandfather. He clearly kept up with it all. The only thing that seemed to lift his mood was his own recent appearance as Stalin in a Georgian film production. "They say I'm a real chip off the old block." And then he stopped and stared at me once more. For a moment it really felt as if Stalin were there. But Djugashvili broke the spell. "Enough," he said, slamming his hand down on the table. His face broke into a weird grin. "I like you. I have decided that. Now I will make you my real guest." In Georgia, a good host usually shows his guest around the farm and the farmhouse. Stalin's grandson showed me his kitchen, then his bathroom shelves. "I built these myself," he said, waving his hand across them lovingly, as if they were a prize in a game show. "And here is the bedroom. And over here, the living room. By the way, you know, I never got anything out of being Stalin's grandson. But of course, when I needed an apartment, I wrote a letter to Brezhnev. They gave me this place. And they jumped me ahead on the waiting list for a car, too. So it hasn't all been bad." "And this," he said, entering the kitchen, "is the kitchen again." Djugashvili yanked a jerry can out from under a table. "Here is Cha-Cha," he said, lifting the moonshine. Then he put a watermelon in my arms, and we marched back to the living room. "Pour out 2 glasses of Cha-Cha," he said. Djugashvili cut thick slices of the watermelon with a curved dagger and salted them. He stood and lifted his glass, and I waited. I stood. "We shall drink to friendship between nations," he said. Fair enough, I thought. And we both downed the cha-cha, a home brew from Tbilisi. On first gulp, the drink did not seem as obvious or as strong as Russian vodka. Djugashvili stood again. "In a Georgian house," he said, "the host makes all the toasts. And in my house, the second toast is always to Stalin." I felt a wave of nausea sweep through me and weaken my knees. But I kept my glass high and my eyes fixed on my hosts. The Soviet Union took on the brunt of the war, and Stalin was at the head of all that, he went on. He took a backward country with peasants in felt boots and made it great. And yet we still curse him. These people should be punished and their lies exposed. I think there will come a day when the Soviet people will give their evaluation. And so, to Stalin. To Stalin, I said. And may God forgive me. By the end of 1988, there were chapters of Memorial in over 200 Soviet cities. A debate was beginning between members who wanted to limit Memorial's attention to the repression during the Stalin period and those who thought it should widen to include all acts from the first arrests and executions under Lenin to the death of the dissident writer Anatoly Marchenko in a prison camp in December 1986. In other words, some Memorial members were beginning to speak not merely of the aberration of Stalin, but of a criminal regime. Novy Mir, Neva, and other journals began to publish articles critical not only of Stalin, but of Lenin and even the revolution. In January 1989, Yuri Afanasyev presided over a 2-day constituent congress of Memorial. Vadim Medvedev, a leading member of the Politburo, tried to shut down the session before it ever began, citing obscure reasons of permission and sanction. Sakharov called Medvedev and informed him that the Politburo had no business getting involved. "If you shut us out of our meeting hall, we will hold the Congress in apartments all over Moscow," he said. Medvedev gave up, and the Congress went on. The Communist Party was beginning to lose control of history, and a party that could not be sure of its hold on the past had to be nervous about its future. But even as Memorial expanded its definition of the past, its essential purpose remained the same: to honor the dead, to give them back their names. Some of the younger historians and volunteers worked on their own to accumulate more information on arrests, executions, exiles. Others made careful studies of existing history textbooks and won a series of critical victories when the party decided to rewrite the school books, eliminate high school ideology exams, and make mandatory university courses in Marxism-Leninism and scientific socialism as optional as basket weaving. No one took the mission of Memorial more literally than Alexander Milchikov, a journalist whose father had been the general secretary of the Young Communist League and head of one of the industrial ministries. Milchikov grew up in the house on the embankment. When he was a child, he saw guards in the courtyard carrying what seemed to be violin cases. In reality, they were cases for their machine guns, he told me. They were ready for action at all times. Milchikov was in his 50s and still lived in the apartment of his childhood when I got to know him. As one of the leading figures of Memorial, he decided to narrow his journalism to a single investigation. According to Roy Medvedev's Let History Judge, around 1,000 people per day were killed during the height of the purges in the late 30s. Milchikov wanted to know where the dead of Moscow were buried. Milchikov's own father was arrested and spent 15 years in internal exile. During those arrests, I was only around 8 or 9. But I was a curious boy and liked to hang around the courtyard. I saw the reaction of the other boys when their parents were taken away. It was a time when you could hear the clomp of high boots on the staircase. The police were in the habit of never using the elevator. I remember clearly how they took my father down the stairs, not the elevator. And so we all listened every night for footsteps. Most of the parents truly believed that there were enemies in the party, and that there was a genuine political struggle going on. They were always surprised when someone was arrested. But their surprise was that someone who they thought was honest turned out to be a traitor. When my father was arrested and our belongings were confiscated, I remember how we children were ousted from our own apartment and we sat in the courtyard on wooden sleighs, and none of our old friends would come near us or talk to us. To talk to a relative of an enemy of the people was the gravest sort of sin. Using Western and Soviet published sources, Milchikov began researching the location of the biggest mass graves in the Moscow area: the Donskoy Monastery, the grounds of a KGB colony in the village of Butovo, the Kolitnikovsky Cemetery near the city pet market, the 14th-century Novospassky Monastery, the banks of the Moscow-Volga Canal. Early one morning, my friend Jeff Trimble of U.S. News and World Report and I met Milchikov outside the house on the embankment and headed for the Donskoy Monastery. The flower ladies in their blue canvas jackets sat near the entrances selling carnations, 5 rubles a bunch. Milchikov led us toward the main building on the cemetery grounds, the crematorium. We walked to the back of the building, where an old man, an attendant, was watching over a small bonfire of garbage. A few broken tombstones lay on the ground. "See this gate?" Milchikov said. "Well, every night trucks stacked with bodies came back here and dumped the dead in a heap. They'd already been shot in the back of the head. You bleed less that way, at the Lubyanka prison or at the military collegium. They stacked the bodies in old wooden ammunition crates. The workers stoked up the underground ovens, right in through that door, to about 1,200 degrees centigrade. To make things nice and official, they even had professional witnesses who countersigned the various documents. When the bodies were burned, they were reduced to ash and some chips of bone, maybe some teeth. Then they buried the ashes in a big pit. We walked for a few minutes up and down rows of tombs, elaborate monuments, that would not have seemed out of place at Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. We stopped at a tomb marked The Grave of Unidentified Corpses, 1930 to 1942. There were four white plastic tulips stuck in the ground, and a stack of rotting carnations that smelled like spilled wine. Someone had also put a tiny icon of St. George near the base of the monument. Melchikov said that the pit had been 5 yards deep and 20 feet square, and when it was filled completely with ashes, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of ash, the secret police paved it over with asphalt. He said there were rumors that Bukharin was buried at Donskoy, but he was not sure. When the purges were at their peak, he said, the furnaces worked all night, and the domes of the churches and the roofs of the houses here were covered with ash. There was a fine dust of ash on the snow. We drove to Kalitnikovsky Cemetery, a dumping ground for thousands of corpses. There was a sausage factory nearby, a fetid place, and Milchikov said, in the purges, every dog in town came to this place. That smell you smell now was 3 times as bad. Blood in the air. People would lean out their windows and puke all night, and the dogs howled until dawn. Sometimes they'd find a dog with an arm or a leg walking through the graveyard. At the Novospassky Monastery, Milchikov showed us the steep bank near the pond, where the NKVD buried the bullet-riddled corpses of foreign communists. John Penner of the American Communist Party, Hermann Remmele, Fritz Schulke, Hermann Schubert, and Leo Fleig, leaders of the 842 German anti-fascists arrested in April 1938, Béla Kun and Lajos Madir of the Hungarian communists, Vladimir Kopik of the Yugoslavian Party, Marcel Pauker and Alexander Dobrojanu of Romania. There used to be apple trees along the bank, he said. They burned them off. They took the prisoners to the monastery church to a room they called the baths. They stripped the prisoners, weighed them, and shot them in the back of the head. In the records, this was called the medical process. They had them shot in a sitting position. A little window would open behind the prisoner's head, and the executioner reached in and fired. They used that method so they could avoid strokes, heart attacks, and hysteria. They stacked the bodies like pencils in a box and carried them off in a horse-drawn cart to a crematorium. Milchikov struggled constantly with the KGB to get permission to carry out excavations on all these sites. The Glasnost KGB, under Vladimir Kryuchkov, was engaged in an extraordinary public relations maneuver. Kryuchkov tried to humanize the secret police, declaring to the press that he was a great lover of theater and dogs and children. At the same time, the KGB did what it could to deflate the likes of Alexander Milchikov. They rebuffed his requests for documents, denied him access to Butovo, and made sure he was followed and harassed when he went on one of his field trips. But the better-known Milchikov became, the more he publicized his findings in a series of articles in Vechernaya Moskva, the more he accomplished. The KGB didn't help him much, but they didn't stop him either. A couple of weeks later, we went together to the very edge of town near a water treatment camp on the banks of the Moscow-Volga Canal. Stalin ordered the construction of the nearly useless canal in 1932, and it was finished in 1937. The workers were slaves, prisoners, most of them peasant farmers, who, because they owned a horse or a cow, were declared kulaks and arrested. Genrikh Yagoda, the secret police chief at the time,
worked the prisoners to death. Milchikov said that around 500,000 prisoners died working on the canal, most of them from cold and exhaustion. Even in winter, they were given nothing more to wear than a thin jacket. The prisoners lived in shabby barracks next to the construction site. They built the 127-mile canal using shovels, picks, and wheelbarrows. Their diet was dismal. Scientists have done analyses of the teeth of the prisoners. From the way the enamel has worn off, it appears that many of the prisoners ate bark, roots, and grass to supplement the bread and thin gruel they were given. Milchikov was not prone to superstition, but in order to find the graves along the canal, he resorted to divining rods when witnesses and guesswork proved unavailing. He had arranged for us to meet with an expert diviner near a certain row of birches. Milchikov assured us that in the past he'd been able to dig up several long mass graves with this man's help. And so for a couple of hours we watched in silence as the diviner paced and weaved through the woods and a flock of jays rioted in the trees. "Someone else is meeting us here, too," Milchikov said. He led me to a monument in the woods, a towering cross wrapped in barbed wire. Memorial had constructed it to honor the prisoners who died building the canal. Next to the cross stood an old, stooped man who introduced himself as Sergei Burov, pensioner. He said that when he was a child of 10 or 11, he had lived near the barracks. Every morning, on his way home from the store, the workers would call out to him to throw them pieces of bread. "I'd wrap the bread in newspaper and throw it," he said. "Sometimes I saw the guards catch them and beat them. I saw the burial teams, too. They were prisoners, and for their work they were given bottles of vodka to keep them drunk. I remember running around quite innocently, playing, and seeing these men in their prison clothes throwing bodies into the ground. Our parents told us about it, and they would say, 'This is some sort of wildness going on.' They just had no idea. They did not want to know." One morning, years after the canal had been completed, Burov said, he was walking beside it and saw some families on the bank. They were all crying. They folded pieces of paper, letters, and put them in bottles. They corked the bottles and threw them into the water. I asked them what they were doing, and they told me they were sending messages to people they had lost on the canal, Burov said. They said they hoped that sometime in the future, people would find the bottles and read the letters and remember. They said they were sending the names of their loved ones into the future. They cast their names on the water. Part 2. Democratic Vistas. Chapter 10. Masquerade. After the Bolsheviks sacked the Winter Palace and seized power in 1917, they still had an empire to win. To help conquer the hearts and minds of the people, Lenin declared cinema the most important of the arts and sent propaganda films and projectionists by train across Russia to advertise the revolution. Stalin, too, saw the value of the new art. Though his preferred instrument of enculturation was the pistol, he told the Communist Party that cinema was the greatest means of mass agitation. And so, for years after the Great October, workers and peasants in makeshift tent theaters and railroad cars watched The Extraordinary Adventures of Mr. West in the Land of the Bolsheviks, Strike, October, and Keno Eye, imbibing all the while the spirit of revolution. But with new revolutions come new media. When Gorbachev rose to power in 1985, his chief ideologist and propagandist, Alexander Yakovlev, declared, "The television image is everything." Yakovlev had been for 10 years an ambassador in Canada, and he often sat at home in Ottawa watching the Canadian and American networks. Yakovlev also studied television in Moscow. For years he worked in the Central Committee's ideology department. Better than anyone around him, he understood the potential of television as an instrument of persuasion, coercion, and homogenization in an empire as vast as the Soviet Union. Though the Soviet Union was poor and primitive, nearly everyone had a television. Everyone watched. Yakovlev understood that if there was one ritual that could unite Baltic intellectuals and Siberian peasants, it was television. Above all, he understood the essential value of Vremya, time, the official evening news program, a prime-time ritual for nearly 200 million people every night of the week. Stalin had been an untelevised tyrant. He was like some magical Eastern god, unseen, rarely heard. The media technology of the day allowed him easy control of his own cult. To a great extent, Stalin's cult was a phenomenon of print, histories, newspapers, textbooks, posters. It was so easy to manipulate. His photographs in Pravda were retouched. Pockmarks disappeared. He grew a head taller. It was impossible to tell he had a withered arm. But as the system loosened somewhat and technology advanced, the people of the Soviet Union came to know the leaders of the post-Stalin era, Khrushchev and Brezhnev, more intimately, mainly through television and the evening news. Vremya was an invention of the Central Committee in the 60s. It was a product designed to be the high mass of a closed, atheist state. The party ideologists shaped the look and sound of the program with painstaking care. After a long search, they discovered their big brother in Igor Kirillov, an unassuming actor of deceptive skill. For 20 years, Kirillov would anchor Vremya. He was slender and wore serious glasses, giving him the unthreatening look of a kindly teacher of mathematics. Such was the public face of the Kremlin. Kirillov was the master of his own voice and presence. Using the slightest gesture or shift in intonation, he made the declarations of the Central Committee seem the revealed wisdom of heaven. He could also report the most ordinary events in the capitalist West as if they were scandals against humanity, a mockery of all that was good and decent. Above all, he commanded attention. "Today, in the Politburo," Kirillov would begin gravely, and every subject would listen, waiting for instruction. Kirillov, like so many servants of ideology, went through a conversion experience born of necessity under Gorbachev. When I saw him at the state television studios in 1991, Big Brother wore a sweater and the hound-dog look of repentance. He was grateful for a second chance, and now introduced various youth programs. He apologized for himself constantly, and wore his cardigan as if it were sackcloth. "The sweater shows I've changed," he said. "The system survived as long as it did thanks to the ideological service of the Communist Party and television. It was a kind of mass hypnosis." For that, Kirillov seemed genuinely sorry. Kirillov had been chosen for his great role, thanks to his training in the Stanislavsky method. "I had the ability to make people believe," he said. Kirillov remembered being overcome with emotion in 1961, when Khrushchev declared on television that the Soviet Union would achieve communism in his lifetime.
And as Khrushchev spoke those words, the sun came out, and the entire hall of Congresses seemed to light up. "See," we told each other, "even nature believes in our cause." That's when my wife and I decided to have our first daughter. We hoped that she would live under communism. Now I am ashamed that I was used as a marionette, and that, through me and through television, a fog was created in the minds of the people. The producers of Vremya knew precisely how to create an imagery of empire and to win over, or at least befuddle, the people. They surrounded Kirillov with the aural and visual symbols of Bolshevik grandeur. When the question arose about what music to use for the opening of the show, the TV ideologists immediately ruled out Mozart and Beethoven. To use German music would have violated the Russian imperial spirit. The opening showed the Kremlin as the symbol of empire. The idea was for information to flow from this mighty pinnacle downward, said Edvard Sagaliev, who ran Vremya for a while under Gorbachev. Vremya was a medium not only to convey information, but also to give instructions, especially to provincial party leaders and to the most ordinary person. It was the singular connection between supreme authority and the people. I personally saw letters from old ladies addressed to Igor Kirillov saying, "Please, dear Igor Leonidovich, tell Gorbachev to do such and such." Kirillov was for many people right between General Secretary and the Lord God. In fact, he was higher than General Secretary, because, after all, it was Vremya that prescribed precisely how to live. Kirillov would read the decrees of the Central Committee without any editing or compression, for such decrees were on the order of the Ten Commandments. It was a biblical phenomenon. How could Moses compress the commandments God had handed down to the Israelites? The rituals on Vremya were always repeated precisely. Even during the Gorbachev era, there was little room for improvisation. If the General Secretary was leaving for a trip abroad, the producers of Vremya knew precisely how to portray the scene. First, the establishing shot at the airport with a red banner reading, "Long live the party." Then the Politburo members in their hats and overcoats coming out of the building to wait by the plane. Then the General Secretary himself saying goodbye, kissing each of his comrades on the cheek. Then the General Secretary at the top of the airplane stairs waving farewell. Faith was the issue, Sagaliev said. People swallowed the stereotypes they were fed. They believed everything was all right, everything was fine, as long as the rituals were in place. Even the kisses at the airport were a cause for pride and joy. Provincial party secretaries watched and dreamed of the day when they'd be shown on television, leaving for Zimbabwe. In Brezhnev's dotage, an interminable stretch on the critical list, Vremya began to work against him. For a man who could barely function in office, television was a cruel medium. Leonid Parfionov, a popular television host in the Glasnost era, told me, with just a touch of irony, that after Andrei Sakharov, the most effective dissident of the 1970s was Vremya. It was only then that people could see how decrepit our leaders were, he said. They'd watch Brezhnev talking, losing his place in his speeches, mumbling like an old man falling apart. And they began to think, this is the leader of our great state? It had never been like that. Not a few viewers understood Brezhnev's deterioration as a new symbol, the symbol of the deterioration of the Soviet Union itself. Gorbachev knew that he could use Vremya, and television in general, to create a public image of himself as new kind of czar. His image, and no other, would embody his policy. Television was still his tool, his to use as he liked. In his first major public appearance as General Secretary, a speech in Leningrad, Gorbachev was so vigorous compared to his predecessors, so critical of the status quo, so informal and unembarrassed by his southern accent and grammatical slips, that he was quickly dubbed the chairman of the collective farm. On television, Gorbachev dove into crowds. No one had to know that the KGB had carefully screened those crowds, or that the producers had carefully edited the footage to the General Secretary's own specifications. The entire state media apparatus was dedicated not to reporting the news, but rather to the evolution of a personality and the promotion of a policy. A new way of doing things. The Kremlin inner circle was obsessed with Gorbachev's television image. Just before airtime, Sigaliev said, Gorbachev himself frequently called the Vremya producers at the studio to go over the details of his appearance. No editing, no visual image or remark, was left to the judgment of anyone but Gorbachev and his aides. Gorbachev's image, Sigaliev said, was carefully planned and organized with the help of the KGB, Gorbachev's staff, and the ideology department of the Central Committee. And, most of all, Yakovlev and Raisa Maximovna helped develop the new image of the General Secretary. Open. Democratic. They wanted him to resemble Lenin. For Lenin's image was that of a simple man who received ordinary people and peasants and drove in a car with no bodyguards. They wanted perestroika to be a return to Leninism, a purification of the party from Stalinism and totalitarianism. Every night people would turn on Vremya, and inevitably Gorbachev would be up to something. Speaking off the cuff at a provincial party meeting, wading through crowds in New Delhi or Bonn, greeting a foreign delegation in a room with a green baize table and a red runner carpet. Gorbachev was never interviewed in the conventional Western sense. A nervous state broadcaster, carefully briefed, would ask a fuzzy, open-ended question. Mikhail Sergeyevich, what hopes do you have for your trip to London? And then Gorbachev would go on for 15 or 20 minutes. By mid-1987, at the latest, urban intellectuals especially sat in front of the television watching this new figure, captivated, a little bit in love. The intellectuals were like film critics who, after sitting through years of depressing schlock, were suddenly shown a print of Citizen Kane. Probably the height of Gorbachev's television career, in Soviet eyes, was his performance at the 19th Party Conference. Not only did he read his own part well, he also directed spontaneity to his advantage, sending up obscure speakers to excoriate and embarrass hidebound Politburo members, setting Ligachev up against Yeltsin to enhance his own stature as the wise, liberal center, flanked by ideological and emotional extremes. Never again would Gorbachev's mastery be so complete. Never would he be as in control of the spectacle of politics. But for several years, Gorbachev not only was the lead actor, producer, and director in his nightly drama, he also had no competition. Vremya played on all the main channels. The educational channel's Italian lessons were not exactly an ideological challenge. For nearly 4 years, there were no competing political actors to speak of. None, that is, who had access to prime time. Yeltsin did not really appear until June 1988, and even then the focus of his attack was Ligachev, not Gorbachev. Sakharov also did not get much airtime until mid-1989. And the right wing was still too bound by the traditions of Communist Party discipline to go on television in the spirit of contradiction. Gorbachev was a lecturer, a cajoler. At conferences and in his meetings on the street, he was a relentless pedant. But for all his power and self-possession, Gorbachev did allow a bit of humor about himself. This, too, was revolutionary. Political humor had always been a staple of private life in the Soviet Union, starring Brezhnev as the doddering fool, or the corpse of Lenin as Kopchushka, the smoked fish. But such jokes were never permitted in official publications. In the March 1988 issue of Theatre, the satirist Mikhail Zadornov adopted the voice of a resident of a town Gorbachev had just visited. He writes a letter to the General Secretary, telling him how the once dingy town had been transformed. "It is true that you informed our local authorities about your visit just 3 days in advance," the mock letter to Gorbachev says. "But even in those 3 days, they managed to do more for our city than they had in all the years of Soviet power. All the buildings that you were supposed to pass were painted. But then someone said that you like to swerve off your planned course, and so our authorities were obliged to paint all the other houses in the city. They worked so hard that they painted the windows, too." The joke was less on Gorbachev than on the vanity of the Communist Party and the Russian tradition of Potemkin villages. But a year later, as Glasnost expanded farther beyond the strict control of the Politburo, the humor cut deeper, and Kremlin patience wore a bit thin. The Gorbachev family was no longer amused. On the stage of the satire theater, one of the actors starring in Vladimir Voinovich's political satire, The Tribunal, Vyacheslav Bezrukov, spun out a long and hilarious imitation of Gorbachev, complete with his signature hand motions, karate chops, raised index finger, odd grammar and accent. Gorbachev's daughter, Irina, was sitting in the third row, and she had been laughing throughout the show. But when Bezrukov started his Gorbachev imitation, Irina scowled. The moment the curtain fell, she headed for the exit, unsmiling, not applauding. Gorbachev did not shut down any theaters, but he did guard his image and his life jealously. Despite his policy of democratization, he never suffered the scrutiny of a real political campaign, much less the assault of a hungry press corps in search of his character. Gorbachev's climb to power took place inside the Soviet Communist Party, an institution that valued aggressive obedience and secrecy. The initiator of Glasnost revealed little of himself except through political performance. When it came to unsanctioned exploration of his personality and his past, Gorbachev was not, at first, much more forthcoming than his predecessors. Even the most liberal papers and magazines did not dare publish what a Westerner would call a profile. Gorbachev insisted on communicating directly with the Soviet people, and the only filter permitted would be the one that he and his staff designed and approved. For all his support of Glasnost, for all his talk of the need to fill in the blank spots of history, Gorbachev kept to himself a central fact of his early life for more than 5 years after coming to power. It was only in December 1990, when he was alienating the entire liberal intelligentsia, including Shevardnadze and Yakovlev, by cooperating with the hardliners in the party, that Gorbachev revealed that both of his grandfathers had been repressed under Stalin. You had to be listening carefully to catch it. Late one night, Central Television broadcast a tape of one of Gorbachev's meetings with a large group of leading writers and journalists. Somehow Gorbachev was trying to justify his swing to the right, but at the same time to win back the respect of the intelligentsia. "Look at my two grandfathers," Gorbachev said. "One was denounced for not fulfilling the sowing plan in 1933, a year when half the family died of hunger." Why now? Why hadn't he said anything in 1988 when the battle for history had been raging? They took him away to Irkutsk, to a timber-producing camp, and the rest of the family was broken, half-destroyed in that year. And the other grandfather, he was an organizer of collective farms, later a local administrator. This was quite a figure for those times. He was from a peasant family, a peasant of average means. He was in prison for 14 months. They interrogated him, demanded that he admit what he'd never done. Thank God he survived. But when he returned home, people considered his house a plague house, a house of an enemy of the people. Relatives and dear ones were not able to visit him. Otherwise, they would have come after them, too. It was as if Gorbachev's family was a paradigm of the Stalinist era. One grandfather was punished for failing to fulfill the absurd and brutal demands of collectivization. The other, a leader of collectivization, suffered for no reason other than to be a victim of Stalin's scheme of organized random terror. When I was up for membership in the Communist Party, I had to answer for all this, Gorbachev told me later in an interview. It was a very painful moment. Throughout the speech, Gorbachev made plain that he himself was the leader of a particular generation with a particular vision. A man of late middle age, born into a system that betrayed his family, but one who is convinced, nevertheless, that genuine socialism was possible, and still my banner. The tragedy of the Stalin era and the farce of the Brezhnev period represented for Gorbachev not the failure of ideology, but rather its perversion. But Gorbachev had not finished. There was a reason for his revelation. It turned out that he had saved his confession for traditional ends. I've been told more than once that it is time to stop swearing allegiance to socialism, he was saying now. Why should I? Socialism is my deep conviction, and I will promote it as long as I can talk and work. By late 1990, political opinion polls showed that only a minority of Soviet people, not more than 20%, still shared Gorbachev's faith in the efficacy of socialism. But attempts to turn away from the socialist choice were inconceivable to Gorbachev. A betrayal, a counter-revolution on the sly. The Baltic independent movements were a threat to his notion of the Soviet Union as one people. He saw the calls for private property as a threat to the psychology of a people who spent years being taught to despise it. The opposition to such foreign ideas, he said, were last stands, comparable to the battles of Moscow and Stalingrad. Am I supposed to turn my back on my grandfather, who was committed to the socialist idea? And I cannot go against my father, who defended Kursk, forded the Dnieper River, knee-deep in blood, and was wounded in Czechoslovakia. When cleansing myself of Stalinism and all other filth, should I renounce my grandfather and my father and all they did? In 1989, I traveled to the scene of Gorbachev's youth, the southern Russian city of Stavropol, and the farming villages nearby. When I showed up at the Hotel Kavkaz, a forbidding old woman with bandaged legs sat squat on a stool, her gaze set on me, barring the door. I tried to get an explanation from her, but I could not. "You'll have to excuse us, but we're having a mass killing in there," said a voice over my shoulder. The local tourist guide, Valentin Nitsin, as it turned out. "We're wiping out the cockroach population. But don't worry, when you get to your room, I'm sure you won't be disappointed." Nitsin was right. Roach platoons raced down the linoleum in columns. Nitsin, who seemed like something more than a tour guide, was extremely interested in why I had come to Stavropol, when there are hundreds of other places for you to go in the Soviet Union. Except to protect friends and sources, I did not conceal much when reporting in the Soviet Union, even in conversations with people I took to be informers. I printed nearly everything I knew anyway. So I told Nitsin that I was there to learn what I could about Gorbachev's past. I was not the first, and Nitsin kindly helped me find a few of Gorbachev's old friends in town. But when I said I wanted to go to Privolnoye, the village nearby where Gorbachev was born and raised, Nitsin stiffened. He would get back to me on that, he said. and disappeared into his office. Within an hour, he told me I could not go. "There is a quarantine in Privolnoya," he said. "It is forbidden to you."
"What sort of quarantine?"
"The cows are diseased, apparently. They do not want any foreigners to come and get sick."
"The cows are against it?"
"No," Nietzsche said. "Not the cows." I knew very well what this meant, and could guess with even more accuracy with whom Comrade Nietzsche had just been talking. But I was tired and angry, and so I pushed things a bit too far. "Mr. Nietzsche, I do not plan to interview any cows, nor do I plan to exchange fluids with one. I told the Foreign Ministry I was going to Privolnoya, and they had no objections, and I don't believe there is any quarantine."
"Oh, but there is," he said. "Hoof and mouth disease."
"Or whatever."
Nietzsche smiled and shrugged in a way to let me know that he knew that I knew, but that was too bad. "You'll have to limit yourself to the city, where we can keep a good eye on you." It was no use, and we both knew it. I gave up, bought Nietzsche a drink, set my alarm for 5 a.m., and went to bed. When I woke up, it was snowing, fat flakes that whitened the grim city. I dressed quickly and walked past the concierge, who was slumped in her chair and snoring. The halls still stank of pesticide, and there were still roaches, thousands of them skittering along the linoleum. On the street I got lucky. I was looking to hire a car, and I found one after only 15 minutes or so. A tiny orange Jiguli with bald tires and a smashed windshield pulled over. Perfect. It would not have been so smart to go to Gorbachev land in a bright yellow taxi. I got in the car and quickly explained to the driver, a young farmer out to make some extra money before breakfast, where I wanted to go. When he squinted quizzically, I added that I was willing to pay $25 in hard currency, a sum that would surely put him in feed until harvest time. Off we went. The driver and I figured that it would be best if we just drove through Privolnoya to get a quick look, and then went to Krasnogvardeskoye, a much larger town where Gorbachev went to high school, entered Communist Party politics, and fell in love. If I was still undetected after talking to people there, we'd stop in Privolnoya on the way back to Stavropol. With so many KGB men around, my luck would surely run out. It was just a question of when. The road was among the most beautiful I'd ever seen in the Soviet Union, including the Georgian military highway through the Caucasus and the flat road through the Karakum Desert in Turkmenia. Snow dusted the rich fields like confectioner's sugar over a black forest cake. In 2 hours of driving, we passed more horse carts than automobiles. Peasant women with silver teeth, humped backs, and mud-covered boots led cows down the side of the road. The lushness of the farmland seemed to me the very soil of Gorbachev's optimism. "You could shove a stick in the ground around here, and you'd get a harvest," people told me in Stavropol. And now I could believe it. Privolnoya was not much different from the village before it and the one after. Peasant huts, livestock, fields. The air was cold and sweet with the smell of fertilizer, hay, and loam. There was one paved road and some dirt ones, all near the muddy stream known as the Yegorlik River. A black bull was tethered to the green fence surrounding Gorbachev's first schoolhouse. Ducks and geese waddled down the road. Privolnoya, which is roughly translated as free and easy, could no longer be called an entirely typical village. Not when the KGB was in town keeping a close watch on the white brick house with blue-green shutters where Gorbachev's mother, Maria Pantaleyevna Gorbacheva, lived. Gorbachev's mother was in her late 70s,
a stout and friendly-looking woman in support hose. Her accent was southern, a peasant's accent. The KGB took great pains to shield her from journalists, but she did appear on television on one of Gorbachev's birthdays, informing the nation that young Misha had worked hard on the farm, read all the books in the collective farm library, and played a mean balalaika. And my, how he could sing! According to people I met who have lived in the village and in villages nearby, Maria Panteleyevna rarely went out anymore. A few years later, when her son was on the brink of resignation, she said perhaps that might not be so bad, since he'd had no time to visit her in years. Accustomed to the pace and the faces of the village, Maria Panteleyevna had always refused Gorbachev's requests to move to Moscow. She did have a few modern conveniences that had not been around when her son lived there. Television, indoor plumbing. She was too old to care for the animals anymore. She said, "At least let me keep the rooster so I'll get up in the morning," Georgi Gorlov, an old family friend, told me. At the very moment when Gorbachev was born in March 1931, southern Russia and Ukraine were living through the collectivization campaign and the starvation that went along with it. According to Western studies, more than 30,000 people in the Stavropol region died during the terror famine of 1931-32. Despite the horror of those years, Gorbachev, like so many reform communists, believed in the idea of collective farms, but abhorred what Bukharin called the Genghis Khan methods of Stalin. Without plunging into the puddle of psychohistory, one might fairly say that Gorbachev's early sense of himself as a success was tied to the collective farm. Working with his father and the family of fellow farm worker Alexander Yakovenko, Gorbachev spent his teenage summers on a rickety S-80 combine harvesting grain. It was hard and filthy work, usually under a broiling southern sun. To cool off, the two boys, Gorbachev and Yakovenko, stripped and sat in barrels of river water. The Gorbachev-Yakovenko team was a local success, so much so that they earned a banner headline in the June 20, 1948 edition of the Road of Ilyich, the local newspaper. Comrade Gorbachev is ready